It's time to clip your last good piece and dig in, because the runout starts now.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Andrew.
I have been struggling hard to figure out what the fuck we're going to talk about on our podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the time of year, I think. Are we getting psyched though for spring? Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that there's just not a lot of like climbing going on at this time of year. And I think that's part of it. So it's like there's just less stuff to respond to. But you came up with this brilliant idea. Which I think is very interesting.
We'll see. We'll see how it pans out here. But yeah, do you want me to introduce it? Well, so what happened was, is today I was working on my kitchen and glancing around every once in a while at Instagram during lunch or something. And I noticed that Bron Hodgins just sent a 14C in Europe, an 8C plus, right? Or I don't know how it works out. But anyway, 14C.
Which is and, a plus.
Yeah. But yeah, then it just occurred to me just how good of a climber she's become. And I interviewed her and Jacob Cook, her husband. They weren't married then, I don't think. Maybe they were, but it was like 7 or 8 years ago. And they were just cruising around, you know, being road dogs. I'd met them in the desert. And, you know, she was definitely like hard second fiddle to Jacob. Jacob had introduced her to climbing, and Jacob at the time was already a really good climber. So she was playing catch up. And then since then, I mean, especially in the last couple, 3 years, she's just like put the hammer down, and it's awesome to see. And I started thinking about like, she did the Necronomicon, that like 13D, maybe 14A-ish roof crack down in the White Rim. You know, they go on these crazy expeditions, new routes on Mount Asgard up in Baffin, and then this Greenland thing, and then now she's like, I mean, yeah, 14C isn't the top end of anything in sport climbing, but to add in the mix,
yeah,
I was like, she's like becoming like Babsy level, like all around amazing rock climber, and it's just through like grit. It, like if you look at her story, it's just like she just works and works and works and works at rock climbing, and it's really paid off for her. So I started to wonder about like that whole thing, the all-around climber, and how there's so much attention paid to top end of like sport climbing and bouldering or whatever it happens to be. That's what gets media, but I think in our heart of hearts as climbers, or at least climbers like us, it's the all-arounder. It's the person who's just excellent or almost excellent at like so many disciplines that, you know, I think is still what we kind of love as climbers. But it just doesn't, it's hard for it to pop out, because it's kind of a difficult story to tell in a lot of ways, because they're never at the very tip top of anything. So it can't be like a breaking hot flash that they did. A woman doing 14C now is awesome, but it's not necessarily newsworthy in and of itself. So,
Right. Yeah.
So I just kind of started thinking about like the all arounder is what we love, and what like in the end of the day, we're like, that person is a badass climber. You know?
Yeah. So,
I want to talk about what it means to be an all arounder, what it takes, and why do we love them?
Yeah. No, it's such a good observation, and it's such a good observation, especially now at this moment in climbing, because you get the sense that it's just, we've reached a point where it's just so hard to find that next level thing in whatever the discipline is, like whether it's like the next big hard route that someone's going to do, or the next free solo, or the next whatever it is. Like if you, any discipline, like V17, we're not going to see a V18 anytime soon, as we've talked about. And so the, all of it's just like kind of reached this kind of plateau in a way, And I think that you're right to draw attention to whatever the all-around climber is. It's just going to become more and more salient as a marker of who we've just like celebrate in climbing. You know, I think it's something that we've always celebrated, but it just hasn't had that like salience that it maybe does now or will in the future. And I think it's going to be in response to the fact that it's going to be so hard to like get to 516A or V18 or whatever the, you know, numerical difficulties are in alpine climbing and so forth.
Yeah, and we've talked to several people, and you most recently Josh Wharton, and he said something that I think both of us nodded our heads at. I mean, I know I did, because he said that, yeah, when I started climbing, this is what you were supposed to do, is become good at all of it, or as much of it as you possibly can. And I remember that feeling as well. Like, you know, there was no, you know, bouldering almost didn't exist. That's how old I am. It did, but it was like no pad, you know, kind of still thought of as sort of practice climbing by most people. And there was a few kind of
there was a few
legendary people who just did that. You know, these guys like Jim Holloway, who, you know, it's like this front range myth, you know, was kind of just a boulder. John Gill, you know, was basically just a boulder, but it was kind of rare. And so you went out and you climbed everything, and you worked up to climbing hard on big mountains was sort of the theory, whether or not you were going to go climb ice and snow, but or on big routes as a rock climber. But yeah, so it's just kind of fascinating that it's like we've sort of lost the art of it in some ways. But I also think it's kind of interesting because, you know, there's like this penchant in climbing for debating. You know, the forums are famous, whether it was the Taco or Mountain Project or whatever. And this is a subject that is like, you can't actually fully decide. You know, we know who's climbed V17, and those few people are the best boulderers in the world. It's measurable, you know. An all-around climber, you know, it's like talking about who's the best basketball player or whatever. It's like really hard to say. And it's up for debate, but I think it's like a healthy, fun debate to kind of talk about it a little bit.
I mean, obviously, all the climbing disciplines, you have to like kind of have do something.
Yeah, even
hard
that's
or
debatable.
Notable. Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, can you call yourself an all-around climber if you haven't done A5 or something like that?
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, it's part of it. But that I kind of was thinking about that. Something we should do is sort of like narrow it down, because do you have to also have alpine arts on your resume? You know, do you have to climb ice or whatever? Or are we just talking about rock climbing?
I don't know. I mean, I think all around is it is like vague on purpose. You know, it's kind of like it seems like you need to do at least three other disciplines. Like there needs to be a trio of accomplishments in different disciplines for you to be an all-around climber. I don't think you can get away with just two. Like you can't be good at bouldering and sport climbing and call yourself an all-around
climber. No,
you know?
No. Those two are too close anyway.
Yeah.
A lot of the people that came to mind in my head, then you kind of, they actually don't boulder very, very hard. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if we wanted to limit to rock climbing, I think that, you know, it's bouldering, sport, trad. But then I think you have to climb big routes, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And you have to climb hard on big routes.
Right. It can't just be, are you saying aid doesn't count for like your big route box?
Well, I think we're going to stick to free climbing.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think for the sake of this particular thing I've been thinking about is, you know, with Braun or whatever, we're talking about free climbing.
Yeah. Nobody aid climbs anymore anyway.
You know, and it's just like, it's such an esoteric thing at the top end, you know, using it for anything but like moving up a wall. And then I've been thinking about too is Nico and his crew went down and freed riders on the Storm recently as well. And it, you know, again, the free climbing part of it is what is impressive to me, not the first ascent. I mean, the first ascent of it was too, but like going back and freeing it is kind of the thing. So
I also think you need to have a first ascent in there too. Like you need to have done a hard first ascent as well.
at least one. It has to be part of your resume for sure.
Like you but can't get about, away with just repeating roots.
What about danger? What about like risky
roots? Well, I
think
if you're going on like big roots in the mountains, isn't that dangerous enough? Or what if you just like go in somewhere obscure, but you just like wrap bolt it and make it super safe? Does that not?
Yeah, I'm just saying
like all around like, climber bona fides.
Yeah. I think that I just remember like Babsy going somewhere where, you know, she kind of had to put the hammer down on like some kind of more run out gear roots kind of a thing. Like I almost feel like I want that out of them as well.
Yeah.
A little bit. So,
okay.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, all around. And then, like I said, do you have to go climb ice? Do you have to climb Everest?
I don't think you need to do that.
No, you don't.
Because that's such a different, I don't know. I mean, maybe you do. I mean, maybe that's part of climbing. And so that needs, you need to have some mountaineering experience, like, or, you know, have climbed up to the summit of something like a volcano in Mexico. If not Everest, which is the hardest mountain in the world, as we all know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, who are you? What are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's rad that I think it's really cool that you're calling attention to Bron's achievements of late, and she's kind of seems a little bit undercover, or doesn't spray about herself in an annoying way, you know. So I'm happy to highlight that, and I think it's rad that she's like, you know, climbing hard in all these different disciplines, and just kind of has always kind of been part of the, you know, the background news of climbing, but has never really peeked through with, you know, something like outstanding or something like that. But I think you're really spot on with just drawing attention to her kind of the whole package of climbing that she's putting together.
All right. So one thing I did do is Google who is the best all around climber in the world.
Okay.
And of course the all around thing kind of, it wasn't pertinent to any of the things I saw. Nobody was sort of making this argument. It was just, or at least there was just kind of this vague notion of it. So anyway, the one I got to is Red Bull has a list here. That's the first thing that comes up is Red Bull's list of the 14 best climbers in the world. Would you like to know who is the best climber in the world according to Red Bull, or would you like to take a guess?
Let's see. Well, since it's Red Bull, it probably is like Will Gadd.
No. Will is not on the list.
Really?
Oh, no.
Oh, man. They're just stiffing one of their own.
Isn't he really more of a nice climber? I mean, I know he started out as a competitive rock climber and is a very excellent rock climber.
Yeah, he's an excellent rock climber.
Yeah. No, it is someone who is coincidentally in a Red Bull athlete.
Hey.
Alberto Lopez.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Sasha DeJulian.
No. She's on the list.
Of course.
But yeah, Alberto, the gold medalist
from
Barcelona, is the best climber in the world.
Best all-around climber?
No, just best climber.
Oh, just best climber. Well, is that because he won the Olympics?
Apparently, yes. He's also.
But has he done Everest?
I don't think so. I think he's laying inside of a hyperbaric chamber as we speak, getting ready. when you think of like best climber in the world, like who are the? Give me a couple of people that pop to your head. Let's see where they rank here.
Adam Rondra, of course.
Okay, Adam Rondra is actually the fifth best rock climber in the world,
according to this dumb Red Bull list.
According to this Red Bull list, he, and with all due respect, he is behind Angie Scarth Johnson, who's number four. So I think that'd be news to Angie. but Angie is, according to Red Bull, a slightly better climber than Adam Rondra is. So that's cool. Now, our old man friend, Chris Sharma, made it. He's number seven. And he
seven?
Actually, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yanya's right in front of him. I mean, give Yanya her due. But he's one up on Alex Honnold. So,
nice.
Yep.
Well, Honnold is for sure on the list.
Yeah, but he's number eight.
I mean, he's on my list at higher than that.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, you know who got sort of grandfathered in, which is, you know, I'm using that ironically because she's not that old yet, but Ashima has been grandfathered in at 9. I only say that because I haven't heard a peep out of her in a long time. And then Sasha's at 10, beating out Tommy Caldwell by 2 points.
Wow.
Tommy comes in at 12.
Damn.
And it also turns out that Daniel Woods is a better climber than Tommy Caldwell, according to Red Bull. Now, here's this crazy thing, though, about this list. Is number 14 is the thing that trips me out, and I love it. And I don't know where it came from. I can't see who wrote this, but fucking Jim Reynolds made number 14
in the world.
Yeah. Remember Jim Reynolds?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is he on that list?
I fucking don't know. It's awesome, though. So, Jim, if you're out there, dog, you made top 14 best climbers in the world right now. And this was, actually posted by Will Gray. Okay, so it was October of 2023, so 6 months ago.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, good job, Jim Reynolds. So,
wow.
And there's this, yeah.
That
there's
is just a
this
wild
tiny
list.
Blurb. Yeah, it's kind of crazy, huh? So, all right, let me ask you this then, real quick. Of that list, who are you think of the people I just mentioned, who fits into the all arounder category?
Well, I still can't get over how Will Gadd's not on their list.
Okay.
I think of course Honnold, of course, yep. Andra. I mean, I think that you
Tommy
have
Caldwell.
To I think the sport and bouldering achievements are kind of like the baseline of what people mm-hmm. do in climbing. And so then you have to add in trad. I think that has mm-hmm. to be part of it. And danger and big roots, those are like maybe swappable for me. Tommy Caldwell, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I think on this list, there's Caldwell, Alex Honnold, Andra, maybe Sasha a little bit. She's mixed it up a tiny bit, but not so much in the trad world. And that's the other thing is most of these people, with, you know, Jim being the glaring exception, don't even climb trad in any notable way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. All right, let me go to another quick list. This is on some website called Flash Pumped.
I think that we need to ask ChatGPT the answer to this. All right, let's see. Who is the best all-around climber in the world? Determining the best all-around climber in the world is subjective and can depend on various factors such as climbing style, achievements in different disciplines of climbing, e.g. sport climbing, bouldering, trad climbing, alpine climbing, and personal preferences. However, some climbers have gained widespread recognition for their exceptional skills across multiple disciplines. All right, already ChatGPT is like way more intelligent on this question than we've been this entire episode. As of my last update in January 2022, one climber often mentioned in discussions about all-around excellence is Alex Honnold. Honnold is famous for his groundbreaking free solo ascents, climbing without ropes of extremely difficult routes, as well as his achievements in sport climbing, trad climbing, and big wall climbing. Yada, yada, yada. Other climbers often regarded highly for their versatility and achievements include Adam Andra, Tommy Caldwell, Sasha DeJulian, and Lynn Hill, among others.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to write back. That's incorrect. The best climber in the world is the person having the most fun.
Oh, God. I knew that was going to come up. This thing, I'm so tired of that.
ChatGPT. That's a wonderful perspective. Indeed, climbing, like any other pursuit, is ultimately about personal enjoyment and fulfillment. Climbing offers a diverse range of experiences. Blah, 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 blah. It says, in this light, the best climber in the world could indeed be interpreted as the person who finds the most joy, fulfillment, and satisfaction in their climbing experiences, regardless of their level of skill or achievement by external standards. After all, the beauty of climbing lies not only in reaching the summit, but also in the journey itself and the moments of joy, camaraderie, and self-discovery along the way.
Oh my God, ChatGTP needs to GT is it GPT what
GPT,
is it
yeah. Chat,
yeah, needs to start a self-help podcast.
It's all about the quietude.
I did look into some forums about this, you know, and into Reddit a little bit, and any discussion about this, serious or not, some fucking asshole had to post that whole fucking, wait a minute, it's, you know, the best climbers having the most fun. Alex, I don't even know if, is that apocryphal? Did Alex Lowe actually say that?
I don't know.
It feels like it's just like, it's become just complete garbage or bullshit now. I don't know.
I think anyway. It's a quote that's super, that preceded him for other sports. And I think he just,
okay,
he adopted it to climbing.
Yeah, anyhow. But yeah, literally it's like, within five or six posts on any forum about who the best climber is, somebody fucking drops that little nugget in there.
It's so annoying.
Which is like, I mean, yeah. All right. So anyway, back to flashpump.com.
Because it's not the discussion that we're having, bro.
No, exactly. All right, back to flashpump.com, which I don't know why I'm even looking at this. This is in no particular order, but they've broadened it out at least more internationally than Red Bull did. So Andra, in no particular order, Andra Magos, Stefano Gisolfi, or Gisolfi, how do you pronounce that? Jakob Schubert, Seb Wong, Yanya Garnbret, Ashima Shiriashi, and Sasha DeJulian.
I wonder if people who are trying to put these together don't have the same definition that we're trying to put down here. Like, they don't include, like, all around for them is they do comps and bouldering and sport routes.
Well, that's an interesting thing because it says here that we're going to concentrate on people who have been climbing the hardest routes outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And they mention the big walls in the other part of it, but it doesn't seem to be part of this consideration.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, is Yanya that known for her outdoor climbing?
I don't think so.
I mean, I know she's climbed hard outside, but yeah, it's not like part of her thing. So anyway, yeah. So back to the people who also go out into the wilderness and climb giant walls. I think that has to go onto your resume.
Yeah.
You know, which is something Braun, who we've started out talking about, has done as well.
Like, you need to be a really good crack climber too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you can't call yourself an all-around climber if you can't climb cracks, I think.
Right. And you have to climb trad, like, at a high level.
Yeah.
I think we're getting into a place where you have to climb trad almost at a 514 level to be considered the best all-around climber in the world.
Are there a lot of 514 trad climbs?
No, but, you know, there's enough.
There's enough.
Or at least close to it.
Yeah. You have to have done at least
Cobra
one.
Cobra crack and things like that, yeah. Mm. So... anyhow.
Well, I think this is a cool concept. I'd like to, maybe if there's a way to codify or like set down some ground rules for like a minimum bar that you need to achieve to be considered a great all-around climber in 2024. Some listener out there can do that kind of Lord's work for us.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to have that conversation and try to come up with like a categorical kind of attempt to codify it in some numbers. But then again, like for me, you know, climbing 8A plus on Riders in the Storm in Patagonia, like beats, you know, even like maybe 14D at the Crag,
mm-hmm.
or maybe even 15A at the Crag for all I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of thing I think like brings the all arounder, especially when they're doing it in shitty conditions, you know?
You know? I'm like envisioning a Brendan Leonard, like semi rad cartoon with check boxes. And like one of them is having the most fun.
And you know who you got to fucking put in that group is like Nico and Sean and those guys.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Cause don't they fucking appear to be having the most fun?
Oh, they probably beat everyone on that box alone, but also all the other ones too.
All the other ones, right? So it's like, you know, so that's like the one where you can just be like, all right, well, we're talking about Nico then, because those guys climb nails hard. I don't know about the rest of them, but I know Nico was a you know, World Cup level comp climber even back in his day, and he was top level sport climber when he was just doing sport climbing.
Maybe he's the answer, Chris. Maybe he's the best all around climber in the world.
Dude, I think he's on my list for sure. Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Wow.
I automatically in the women's category go to Babsy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about if she's having the most fun, but she's Austrian, yeah, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah, she's a little too Austrian to have the most fun.
Yeah, the Germanic peoples, it's hard to tell when they're having a good time. Just in general, yeah. Right?
They enjoy just crushing whatever it is that they're doing.
Yeah, they're getting a lot of fun out of just like crushing. That's what brings them joy, even if they have a very straight face at the time. So,
nice.
Do you have to free solo?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe you have to be comfortable doing it at some level, but right. I don't think you need to be. Well, first of all, it'd be a moot point because no one is like really pushing the limits in that, except right. for a couple people out there. But that to me doesn't feel like it fits as a requirement for all around climber. Like if someone free solos or don't, I don't really like pretty much everyone can free solo like, you know, 5'8".
Right.
And so who cares?
Where's Hazel fit into the conversation? She's an all arounder.
Definitely below Jim Reynolds. But above Ashima.
I don't know. How are her katana skills, though?
She's.
Because that's where Jim dominates.
Beth Rodden is a climbing icon and legend who needs no introduction. Her new book is called A Light Through the Cracks.
Well, I wanted some sympathy because I downloaded whatever version of the book we have this early. It's done or close to done, I'm sure. But I downloaded it onto my Kindle and it's a PDF. Can't really enlarge it. And so I read it in like the tiniest type on my on my Kindle. And I read the whole thing in a day.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I read, yes, like for real read it because I was on an airplane and then in the airport. But I just wanted noted what I went through for you,
it's
Beth,
amazing.
To read your book. It was
that's
just
impressive.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done it.
And also you have you've got your grandpa setting on your iPhone anyway, where your types in the largest possible font.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. It's like, that's what I need to use my iPhone. But then I had to read this thing. And like, so I was like on the plane, you know, I'm sure whoever's sitting next to me is like, what is that guy doing? Like, they probably wanted to reach over and show me how to like get the print bigger. He's like, oh, he doesn't know how to use his Kindle, but it's awesome. I was drawn in. I couldn't put it down. I didn't just do it for the show, but because I totally planned to skim it, I'll be honest with you, but then I didn't. So just because it was like,
good.
I was,
you totally should.
No, I mean, I just, because I was like, I got like a half a day to get this book to where I can talk about it. And that's kind of what you do sometimes, is just like, you know, pick some paragraphs or pick a chapter or two. But I read it cover to cover. Anyway, wow. Welcome to the show, Beth. Please
Thanks for
feel for me.
I do. I'm actually really impressed. I definitely wouldn't have had that wherewithal.
Beth, I'm going to just take in a guess here, because I think that we're similar in the sense as writers, where a lot of the writing that we do is for us, or for, you know, for ourselves. And the idea that people actually read what we write is sort of mortifying and kind of not always top of mind. So, you know, you've got this big book coming out and people are going to be reading it. And it's a wonderful read because it's the prose is very fluid and it's just easy to get through. And despite being difficult subject matters at times, but it's just, it reads quickly. It reads well. And it's a great book. So, have you processed the fact that there's going to be, you know, hopefully millions of people reading your book in the near future?
Well, aside from you two, I was really thinking it might stop with like my parents and granny. So, yeah, I've been questioning it, honestly, quite a bit lately. I'm like, so why did I do this? And I don't know, but in the end, yeah, it is really mortifying and going to be really awkward. But in the end, it's like, you've got your people around you and that's all that really matters, right? It's like, if your family still can tolerate you and your friends still like you, then I feel like that's all that really matters. Other people can have their opinions and they will have their opinions, and I'm sure some of them will make them known, and but you can't control that. So that's what I'm trying to hold on to in my better times.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that Granny's still around. Mm-hmm. She's mentioned in the book, and you know, it's a lot of it's from quite a few years ago. So here, Granny. You know, I was thinking about this. It's interesting that Andrew's opened with this as well, because it's extremely personal book. Like, not like any climbing book I've seen. I guess Kate, you know, I'd put Katie Brown's in there too, as being extremely personal. And when it gets extremely personal and you're talking about trauma and about relationships, then it gets personal for people who didn't write the book. And the interesting thing, I was reading it, and so much of it, you know, is about your work on self-confidence, on dealing with who you are, you know, whatever that happens to mean. But one of the things in it is that, you know, that's that self-consciousness about what other people think about you, what other people are saying in their heads. You know, you spent a lot of years creating these narratives that were probably not true, but you believed what these people were probably thinking. And so I was just thinking, like, wow, writing this book, like, you just head-on into this thing that you've dealt with your whole life. And it's like alcoholism. It's like you can go to therapy and you can get better at it, but it's always there. So just tell me about the decision to do it and confront this stuff on this level when it really, like, plays to your, it's kind of your weakness in a way. You just ran into it with a dump truck, kind of. It's pretty cool. It's pretty wild.
I feel like this book has changed so much over the years. What am I? I'm 43 now. I thought that I should write a book even in my 20s, right? Just as like the box to check as a professional climber. You know, it's like free LCAP, climb 514, write a book. You know, it's just like I felt like I should do it. And then during my divorce, I feel like I wanted to write it for a different reason. And then over the last decade, it's really, I mean, it's just changed so much, right? And with any really personal story, obviously it's going to morph over the years, because how your life trajectory goes is going to change. How you think about your past is going to change. So I feel like there were so many different points when I thought I should write a book. And then also when I wanted to write a book. And then also very much when I didn't ever want to write a book. And this whole thing was this like autonomous being of itself, just living, you know, on my little tab on the computer that I would just like go and I'd work on. And then, I mean, sometimes it would be like 8 months, 12 months that I wouldn't work on it. And then I think just in general, I feel like I don't think I could have written it without just, like you said, ramming a dump truck into it, right? I don't think you can. That's not the type of person I am. I feel like that's not the type of book, if I had one, that I would have wanted to write, kind of like this glossed over fluffy piece, you know? Because that's not, I don't know, that's not what gets me going. That's not who I am with my friends or my family. That's not like what I find interesting in people. And that's not what I can really bite onto with relationships, right? And also with other books, like, I don't really get lost in those books. I get lost in the fascinating ones that people just bare their soul and make you feel less alone, because you think all of a sudden, oh, wait, I'm not the only one who feels that way, or I'm not the only one who has those, what I thought to be, you know, totally wild thoughts or whatnot. So, yeah, I don't think that was ever a question for me. Like, if I was going to have this out there, to have it be a glossed over fluffy piece, like, marketing thing, that's just also not who I am. You know, I'm not that type of person. So I feel like I don't know. It just was never a question of whether to do that or not. It was a big question at times on whether to do a book. I think this book would have been written regardless. It's just whether I put it out there or not. You know, it's like when I was younger, I was somebody who kept journals and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just always been something that to process thoughts and events and things like that. So
I'd like to give listeners context a little bit about just who you are and your story here. And so we can get into some of the details of the book, because one of the most important events in your story is almost 24 years old at this point. And so I think there's a lot of, hopefully we've got some young listeners out there too young to remember that. But it's possible they're all just, you know, as old as we are, in which case
it's likely actually, but yeah, there's probably a few.
you know, but of course, you know, you and Tommy Caldwell occupied this space in, you know, American climbing and global climbing is kind of being like the biggest names in the sport in a way. And, you know, you're freeing roots on El Cap. I think Lurking Fear is still the location of your first date, I believe, you know, is still an unrepeated free ascent on El Cap. I'm not sure if it's been repeated or not actually, but no, it hasn't. Okay. And, you know, you've freed the nose and done, you know, Meltdown, which is perhaps the hardest crack climb in the world. It's certainly one of the hardest pitches of trad climbing around, you know, and that went another decade without having a repeat. So you have this like amazing background and career. And I think I certainly, you know, grew up in the era where, you know, you were among the luminaries of the sport and the icons and heroes that, you know, I looked up to. But kind of beneath all of this was this horrible event that happened to you in Kyrgyzstan, where I'll let you tell us about the details of what happened. But I think a lot of us didn't realize the effect to which that was kind of roiling your approach to life and your sense of self and so forth. But please maybe just tell us in your own words, like what Kyrgyzstan was and maybe go into how that affected your climbing.
Yeah, sure. And to be fair, I didn't even realize, you know, the impact and the effect it was having on me, right? I think that was a big part of it. But yeah, for those of you who might be listening who don't know about what happened, myself and Tommy and then two good friends at the time, Jason Smith and John Dickey, we went on a climbing trip over to the Karasu Valley in Kyrgyzstan. It's the neighboring valley of the more popular, well-known Aksu Valley. And this was back in 2000, in the summer of 2000. And I'm going to get some of the details wrong here, so forgive my failing memory. But I think we were supposed to go for about 6 weeks, something like that, to go, you know, free climb big walls. We were all valley people, and that's like what we ate and breathed and everything, is we just loved free climbing on big granite walls. So we all got together and decided to go there. And when we first got there, it was all kind of going swimmingly. And, you know, we were the only team in this huge valley. And it was, you know, for lack of a better word, it was kind of like an alpine Yosemite setting, if that makes any sense. It's these big granite walls flanking each side of the valley. And then at the back of it are these like big snow-capped mountains. And yeah, it was, you know, I think I had gone to Madagascar with my hero Lynn Hill on a trip the year prior, maybe 2 years prior. Tommy grew up with his dad, you know, traveling all around the world. So he'd climbed a lot of places. Jason had done the same, gone to Baffin and stuff. So it was kind of like we were living out our wildest dreams. I was on my quote unquote year off of college, and it was great. I don't really know how else to say it. It was just like what climbers dream of, right? You go and you look at these granite walls, and some of them are unclimbed, some of them only have aid routes, and you start climbing on them. But then I think, again, faulty memory, maybe a couple weeks into the trip. We were on the side of this wall. It wasn't necessarily a super impressive wall, but, you know, the first one that we were climbing. And it was the morning after Tommy's 22nd birthday, I want to say. And we woke up to these really loud noises, bangs, but we all kind of just immediately thought that it was a rockfall because, you know, you're just in this remote alpine valley. And that's kind of what you think about when you're climbing on these walls, that bad things could happen. It'd be a rockfall. So we all sat up and like put our backs against against the wall. And then when it happened again, we looked down and there were armed men shooting up at us. And I would venture to say we were probably like 1,000 feet up, something like that. So John was the oldest at the time. I think he was like 25 and he offered to wrap down and, you know, see if he could sort it out or see what they wanted. And then eventually we all went down and they marched us back to our camp. Again, I might be giving you just like the glossed over version. I'm happy to go into detail, but also I think it could probably take the entire hour or two or whatever that we have. But it was just apparent we were being taken hostage at that time. You know, like these men that they have like necklaces of bullets and like grenades on their belts and automatic weapons. It's just basically like what you see in the movies. They're just like standing in front of us. So we were being taken hostage. And over the next 6 days, we went through one battle between the rebels and the Kyrgyzstan military. There was a Kyrgyzstan military fellow hostage who they executed. And then I don't know. We have no idea. They didn't speak English and we didn't speak their native language, what their plan was with us. But through 6 days, we basically did a huge circle in the mountains. They hit us every day in these places that you wouldn't necessarily think like a house dog could fit, you know, like under these boulders, and they'd like cover us. And it was like, just very small places that they would hide us. And then at night we would just walk. One of the biggest things was, is we just had like the clothes on our backs, you know, like what I'm wearing, just like a, you know, light jacket and stuff. And we were at like 11,000 feet. So, it was freezing and we only had like, we stuffed some power bars in our pockets, like when we left our camp. So we either like split a bar each day or we had a bar each day. So, you know, just a couple hundred calories. So we were starving and freezing. And then at the end of the sixth night, we were left with just one captor and we were supposed to meet our other captor on the top of this ridge. We ended up like very near our original camp and he was going to go back and get like batteries and food and like warm clothes and maybe some new contact solution and contacts for Tommy. And so we were supposed to meet on top of this ridge. And for us as climbers, you guys wouldn't even think about it, you know, like you're just kind of like scrambling up. But our captor was super uncomfortable. It wasn't terrain that he was used to. And so the entire time, John and Jason had been talking about trying to escape somehow, which just seemed preposterous to me because I was like, well, they're just going to kill us. Like, there's no way we're going to be able to do this. But at this night, you know, it kind of seemed like this was our best chance if we wanted to do that. And so Tommy went up and he pushed him off the ridge and then he fell out of sight and we just, you know, adrenaline shot through our veins and we just ran as fast as we could down canyon where we knew there was like a small military outpost. And we were shot at again right before we got to that outpost by the Kyrgyzstan military, probably thought we were rebels. And then, but once they realized that we weren't, we were taken in and we went from like one military base to another, like over some helicopter rides. And eventually we got to the American embassy in Bishkek, which is the capital. And then eventually after some more time debriefing and stuff there, we made it home. So it's like the short and condensed or not version. of Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, I mean, the details of it are in your book. And the detail with which you describe it in the book is the most I've seen anywhere by a long shot, actually. Pretty fascinating, even after, like Andrew said, 24 years to, you know, read another account of it that I think goes as deep as yours does. So, yeah, the details start to make it much more scary. And it's an interesting thing because, and you talk about this as everybody kind of was like, wow, what a rad adventure, you survived, you know, like it's almost was like this badge that people wanted to give you. And I was kind of part of that group too, to be honest with you, like, oh fuck, they survived. What a amazing thing. You know, it's like a movie or whatever.
I mean, I feel bad for Greg Child because, you know, he was hired to write the book about it right afterwards. And I can only speak for myself, but like, I was zero capable of talking about it in any detail at that point. Because, I mean, he was interviewing us, what, just right immediately afterwards. So, you know, it takes a while to process it and even allow yourself to remember what happened. Because I think, for me at least, it was just such a coping mechanism to just get by that to have to remember those details, let alone like speak them and tell them to somebody, is just like the next level. But yeah, I mean, that was the climbing community back then, right? And even a little bit now, it's just like everybody celebrated that stuff. Oh, you lost a leg getting to the top of the mountain? Like, amazing. It's like, but how was that for you? You know, like, how are you doing? It's just like, oh, you like survived this crazy epic? Like, you're the best. Like, here you go. And you're just like, but Jesus, I can't sleep at night, you know? Like, I see threats everywhere. So it's like, it's just interesting to see what, I mean, nobody can walk in anybody else's shoes. So I don't think there was any malice to it, but it definitely, in hindsight, was not, you know, it's not the most conducive healing environment, that's for sure.
Obviously, I think the word PTSD is applicable here, and it's a phrase that gets used very casually, and you know, in just our normal vernacular. And but I think your book certainly articulates the ways in which just the ripple effects that this one event has through your life, and how it affects your relationships, how it affects your sense of self, the resentments that you hold, perhaps unfairly, to people, and coming to terms with those. But I want to talk a little bit more about that because it's so fascinating to your story, just in terms of how you managed to spend the next decade after this event climbing at such a high level and being so successful. And so I'd like to hear what you attribute that ability to. And then I think the other part of that question is when did you first become aware that these were, issues that you kind of needed to address, or when did it first start popping up in your awareness as sort of something that, you know, was maybe influencing how you see the world?
Yeah. I mean, those are great questions. For the first one, I mean, I don't know if I have a good answer, right? It just felt like that's what I always wanted to do, right? Like, I always wanted to be a great climber, and I always loved climbing. And so it just seemed like, why not marry those two things, right? And try and go out and climb my hardest and dream these big dreams. And it also feels good, right? You get all this external validation and praise, and that fills a space inside of me, you know, that it felt really good. And I loved it. So I feel like, I'm sure there are deeper reasons, right? Like that external validation, but I also really love it. Like, we all love climbing, right? And even now, like, I really like climbing my hardest, whatever that is, 5.9 one day, you know, 5.12 another day. Like, it's really fun. And so I think also was a good distraction from other things that were going on inside of me. I definitely didn't have the words for that at the time, right? Because it just felt like it was the dream anyways, right? Why not go climb these goals and things that Tommy and I dreamed up, and then also get be paid for it, you know? So it was great. I don't look back on it with any bad thoughts, and it's not like wholeheartedly a terrible experience, you know? Yes, there are hard times in it, but I also look back on it with a smile, you know? It's like Tommy and I were up there and he was doing his thing and I was doing my thing and we were supporting each other and it was great in a lot of ways, but it was also not great in some ways. And I think I started to realize, I don't think I started to realize Kyrgyzstan or the after effects of it were an issue until I became a mom. This is probably going to seem wild. I didn't even think about Kyrgyzstan through my 20s. Like literally it was something that happened and I got to where I could sleep through the night again. And then I had like a canned 3 to 5 minute version of what happened. And other than that, like I wanted to distance myself as far from Kyrgyzstan as possible. Like I didn't want to be known for Kyrgyzstan. I wanted to be known for climbing. It seemed like a tarnish for me. I think I started to think about that time of my life, like right before my divorce and during my divorce, because how could I not start to excavate things in my past going through such an upheaval in my life, you know, such a departure from how I was living. And then Randy, my husband, he mentioned things, you know, a few times before we had our son. And I just like scoffed at him. I was like, you have no idea what you're talking about. You didn't live through it, in response to like some behaviors that I was having. But it wasn't until I was a mom that it was just like someone holding up a mirror. And I just like saw how I was living in life. I was like, I can't. I just can't keep doing this. I've got this like little human who is this sponge and he's just like absorbing everything that his parents do, you know? And obviously we're all going to mess up our kids in certain ways, you know? It's just like part of being a parent and doing your best, and you're going to mess up. But this was a way that I was like, I can't at least try to get better, a little bit better with this, you know? Like I can't knowingly just keep ignoring this. So that's when I was just, you know, finally I was like, okay, I should like try and go to therapy. But I was terrified to go to therapy. Because I mean, like you said, it's like 15 years later. And it was like this full on survival coping mechanism not to talk about it. And so the thought of just like opening that door and just like diving in is just like really scary, you know?
How did that manifest itself when you were saying that it was because you had a kid? And I mean, what were the behaviors that you felt were sort of influencing him or inappropriate around him? Was it short of temper? Was it paranoia, things like that?
I had like slowly become a germaphobe, right? Because I saw threats everywhere. And so like I was terrified for him to basically like be a human in the world. You know, I was like, oh, he can't go in the sun. He's going to get a sunburn. He can't go that place. He's going to get sick. He can't go anywhere where there are mosquitoes. He's going to get West Nile, you know, like all these things that you have to be like, you're a human, you know, you have to, there's things in life you just got to deal with. So I became in that way that was really hard, but more so, and you know, it's like, it's hard to talk about this now, but I was always very afraid of, you know, certain people. And there was this moment where I forget how old he was, maybe 2, something like that. And we were just in a park, you know, like the most innocent place, this little tot park, and having a great time, you know. And it's just like, you know, that time when your kids are in their life when everything is like wonder, you know, they're like, oh, look, a rock. And they're just like, wow, you know, it's just like that time of life. And so he was just like soaking everything in. And this family walked in and the mom was wearing a hijab and there was a little boy like Theo's age. And I just was, I totally panicked, you know, like I had this visceral reaction that I think I had so often the previous 15 years. But when it was just me, I felt like, you know, I can just like live in my little bubble and just like move through life in this not good way, but, you know, maybe nobody will notice, or, you know, I just have to answer to myself with that. But I picked Theo up and I made us leave, you know, at that point. I was like so full of this like sour feeling of fear, I remember. And then I remember that's like, that was a big turning point, because I was just like, that's not right. That's not how I want him growing up and how I want him looking at the world and people, you know. That's, and so that was the big turning point. I think I started therapy shortly after.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That's really, I mean, those are all vulnerable and painful things to talk about and admit, I'm sure. I mean, it's interesting too, because the, you know, you're speaking to this like kind of unaddressed fears that you held that you weren't really conscious of during the kind of height of your climbing career. And, you know, it's interesting to consider, you know, I'm sure you went on other trips abroad and stuff, but you certainly haven't, to my knowledge, done another kind of dream expedition or, you know, to a Kyrgyzstan like place. And so, you know, your climbing was this outlet too, but it was also very limited in terms of its scope or maybe what you could have otherwise done had you not had this like really traumatic event happen in life. Have you ever thought about what could have been, or what, you know, what kind of climbs you could have done or places you could have been that, you know, were closed off to you for these reasons?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember pre-Kyrgyzstan, like I wanted to get into alpine climbing and I wanted to go to Patagonia and I wanted to go to, you know, all these places. I grew up a very privileged, sheltered life, you know, in white suburbia. And at least back then, you know, climbing, it was a little bit fringe, you know, like we all like slept out of our cars and lived off like $5 a day and, you know, did all that sort of thing. So I was kind of like, yeah, look at all these places I'm going to go, you know, check that out. And so I did have a list and I did always want to do that. But I think after Kyrgyzstan, I never have had the desire ever again to go to a place that, right or not, is considered like maybe a little harder to go to. Obviously, like danger can follow you anywhere, right? In your backyard and in the safest, quote unquote, safest places on the earth. But I thought that maybe if I could take away some of those known layers of danger, right, then that would protect me a bit more. So yeah, I mean, like, I went climbing in beautiful places, right? I got to go to Norway and South Africa and Europe and Canada and all that sort of thing. But rationally or not, I thought that if I could make sure that the place didn't have any State Department warnings or, you know, known threats in a certain way, then maybe that would keep me a bit safer from certain dangers. Obviously, there's always dangers no matter what, walking out your door, going 2,000 feet on a wall, whatever. But that part, I didn't ever feel like I could face again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's fascinating because you're just talking about the way most people see the world. I mean, you know, when I go on any of those trips, my parents are like, why are you going to that place? Like even Mexico, you know? And so it's, you know, part of climbing is to sort of want to do those things, but most people don't. I mean, most people think exactly like that. Like, I'm going to go to Norway. I'm not going to go to Nicaragua or whatever, you know? So it's, yeah, I don't know. It's just sort of ironic that, that it just was like making you think in the way most people think in this kind of weird way. But, you know, one of the things in the conflict that came out of between about your marriage and the way Kyrgyzstan sort of fit into it is that, you know, Tommy had this like, you know, use this to become more resilient and we'll just like forge forward. And you sort of got, were on that ride as well. And it's kind of fascinating the way this, because Andrew asked about like your ability to do these hard things after that. But the training part of it was a really interesting detail in this book, because the amount and the zealousness at which you went towards training when you had climbing goals was kind of bonkers. And like, maybe it's just a glimpse into what it takes. And I'm sure that's part of it. You know, as a pretty good climber, I like to think that like, you know, those guys are like stronger than me, but it's because they, you know, they spend a couple more hours on the hangboard than I'm willing to do. But that's not the case. Like, your training was kind of bonkers. Like, even, you know, building a training wall on your land long before you built a house, and hours and hours and hours. And it seems like that did like the sort of hiding from your thoughts about Kyrgyzstan or however you want to put it, like that helped in this strange way. Like, you could just obliterate yourself so you could fall asleep and things like that, which then resulted in freeing the nose and resulted in meltdown. And, you know, so I don't know if you have a comment on that, but it's like it was sort of a, I mean, it was a curse certainly, but then it had this like fuel in it as well, it seems like.
It's so easy in life to paint things as black or white, mm-hmm. right? But it's, life is just so much more nuanced than that, right? And so that time wasn't all bad and it wasn't all good. It was a lot of both, you know? And yeah, I mean, our training was, there was zero science behind it. So it produced fairly good results for us at the time, but like, we had no idea what we were doing. You know, I mean, now it's like there's such science behind it. But yeah, I mean, I
science,
still like
science, when- like obliterating yourself is still the way it's done.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I haven't had a formal training plan ever, but it seems like it works for a lot of people right now. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it's just there's a lot of good things that come out of things and that are both good and bad. And am I psyched I freed the nose? Yeah. It's like, it literally was my lifetime goal. You know, I'm so happy about it. Could I have done it, you know, in a different way? Like, in a different scenario? Like, had I gone to therapy? Had I not been with Tommy? Who knows? You know, all I can say is like, I know that I could do it with Tommy in that scenario, and I feel super lucky to have been able to do it. So I'm sure like I could go and dissect the past and try and see if there was like a more perfect way to walk through life. But I also just don't think that's life, you know. Life is full of nuance and up and down. And yeah, I feel like our training worked for us, and you know, how we worked together worked for us for a pretty darn long time, you know, nearly a decade. And then it didn't at some point. And that's also life, you know.
Over the last decade, you've you know, been sharing a lot of these kind of more vulnerable thoughts about various topics. And you've been doing that on social media. And what role do you attribute that ability to kind of communicate with climbers or people, just the public broadly, in terms of how you've made progress in terms of your, some of these issues that you're dealing with? I mean, I get the sense that you've been very scared to like share some of these details with folks, but I don't know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what the response has been and how that response has kind of encouraged you and maybe even helped you move toward finishing this book.
Yeah, I think I, like you alluded to in the beginning, I have a love-hate relationship with having any of my life public, right? Like, it's in a lot of ways, it's just easier and probably safer to just live your life with your family and your friends, and that's it, you know? But I've gained a lot of strength seeing other people share really vulnerable moments. And it's given me, it's been a catalyst inside of me for change as well. And then I've seen myself be able to grow in ways that I didn't think possible, you know, like Kyrgyzstan or eating issues and body image issues. And what a gift that is, right? To be able to have a change inside yourself that you never thought possible, you know? And I definitely know that that happened on several occasions from seeing other people, you know, share their struggles, inner thoughts, vulnerabilities, whatever, however you want to label them. And it's not like I went out being like, I want to be this person. It was just more of a quiet way of putting stuff out there, you know, and saying, hey, you know, I go through this and I think of things in this way, or, you know, I experienced X, Y, or Z. And I never thought that it would have the impact that it did with people. You know, I'd never thought I'd hear from all the people that I did and that sort of thing. So in that way, it's been pretty mind blowing and pretty wild. I think that it was never meant to be a loud thing. It was meant to just put something out there, because I know that in a lot of times, in a lot of different periods in my life, I would have appreciated it, and I have appreciated it. So I feel like what bigger gift than to have that, you know?
You know, the thing too is that you evolved yourself, but and it also kind of, I feel like you evolved with climbing. And I don't know if it's a, you know, it's a chicken or the egg thing where climbing's evolving and then you tagged along, or you were just part of that evolution. But we've come into this period, I think, where people want to know sort of more intimate details about their kind of climbing heroes. If you, you probably blush at that, but certainly you're in there. I mean, Andrew and I both were in the era when you truly were one of the top end climbers. But we kind of want more from our celebrities, just like in the greater culture. But also I was thinking about how the amount of women climbing has also blown up quite a bit. You know, we're supposedly, at least if you include gym climbers, we're nearly at parity. I think it drops quite a lot as we get into the various disciplines of outdoor climbing. But nevertheless, the last decade has seen this real boom in women climbers. And I think, not that you're entirely women's issues oriented, but, you know, you talk about parenting as a mom. You talk about, I think, a lot of body issues that impact women more so than they do men. That's just obvious. And then you've also walked into this scene where social media has made a lot of these things harder for women. We've been learning all about the impacts of social media on young women in particular. So it's just like your evolution kind of, like, fit the zeitgeist, I think, in a lot of ways. And that's probably why it was received the way it was versus 20 years ago. There might have been a lot more deaf ears to the kind of things that you wanted to say had you said them in 2000 versus in the last 5 or 6 years. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
No, I mean, I fully agree with that. Like I think the examples are endless of how there wouldn't have been space for talking about these issues back when I started climbing, when I was at the peak of my career, any of that. I mean, there were so many examples of why not to talk about any of this stuff, right? And I learned quick, you know, you smile, thanks for the free gear, thanks for the raise, and be the, you know, the good girl that keeps on charging along. So you get paid, so you get your spot on the cover of the magazines. You know, I wouldn't say a wholeheartedly different culture back then, because there's totally still threads of that in our culture, our climbing culture, but it was a big departure from where we are now. That's for sure. You know, there's like one girl on each climbing team back then, you know. I can only speak to myself, but I was so competitive with every other one, because why would you befriend that person? Because if they're going to be better than you, then they're going to take your spot at the table, you know? And so, I feel like now is just in in society in general, we're just much more open to talking about these things, you know, that were once just lived in the shadows. So I think that's great for humans in general, but I think we can, there's a lot farther we can go too.
I want to coax you out of being vulnerable, Beth, and into jaded, opinionated Beth, because I know that side of you exists too, which is one of the reasons I like you so much. But you have a little hobby horse that I think we've batted around on this show about just the role that social media has played in terms of how professionalism is kind of awarded or lauded. And I think you've made the point about the magazine cover being the kind of gold standard of a professional climbing career and what it took to get there, and versus today's climate of, well, I'll let you describe it, but how would you like characterize that kind of evolution in how achievements are sort of noted in the climbing community?
Yeah, I mean, it was much more cut and dry back then. You know, I sound like the jaded, back in my day, you know.
That's what this show's all about.
Yes. That was our original title for it. It was back in the day, or it should have been anyway.
Yeah. So back in my day, how deep do we go here? It was like, if you were pushing the sport forward, right? The people at the magazines, the almighty magazines, noticed, and you got in hot flashes, you got a feature, maybe you got a cover, you know. So it was all about pushing the sport forward and letting your climbing achievements kind of speak for themselves. And I guess they didn't speak for themselves, the people at the magazines spoke for them, but that's what it was, right? It was like the magazines were the gold standard. And self-promotion back then was actually totally frowned upon. Like, I knew people that they weren't even self-promoting like you have to now, but it was just like maybe a slight self-promotion. And they were kind of like shit-talked, you know, and like thought of not in the best light if you at all said something about your achievement. In fact, it was more like you needed to downplay who you were and like, way better to undergrade something than overgrade something. You know, it was all just about that, whatever, being humble to a fault and doing it that way. And now, gosh, I cannot even imagine trying to like push the sport forward or like be known for my actual just rock climbing now. Doesn't it just seem awful? Like, you just have to talk about yourself all the time. Like, I wrote like 300 pages about myself, and that just feels wrong. And like, can you imagine having to go on social media and just like, look at this boulder problem I did, and look at this route I did, and like this is so great. Oh, just sounds so hard and terrible, doesn't it? Like, oh, like at least I'm talking about like, I don't know, stuff I'm not proud of when I go on social media now, but to have to brag about yourself just seems so hard.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I think you're accurate in identifying the dysfunction with the generation of people who are fine promoting themselves on that level. But there's also, you know, speaking of therapy, there's also some work that people of our generation need to do about ridding ourselves of the negative self-deprecating averse to accepting a single compliment pathologies that we all have.
Yeah.
There's probably a middle ground somewhere that we'll
maybe. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, I don't know. And that's the thing is like, you know, I have friends of that generation, people that are amazing and whatnot. And I think you're right. They don't think of it as the worst thing in the world. You know, it's just like what you have to do now, you know, and it's not sacrilege. It's not awful. It's just part of it. And I think we just have this thorn in our side that's just like, oh God, that's so hard to do, you know, but for them, it's just like lacing up your shoes and putting chalk in your chalk bag. It's like, well, just got to do it.
Well, let me task you with spraying about yourself. When you look back on your climbing achievements, what are you kind of alluded to the nose being your big life goal, but is how does Meltdown or any of the other things that you've done fit into that? What are you most proud of climbing during your peak?
I don't know. I think it changes all the time, probably, honestly. I started climbing the year Lynn did the nose, right? And so it was like the biggest thing out there. And so during my climbing, I always just thought of it as the biggest thing. And I never thought I'd be able to be as good as Lynn. And so to be able to actually do the nose, and I should just say, I don't think I'm as good as Lynn, nor do I ever think I'm as good as Lynn. But to be able to do the nose was just like, you know, a lifetime goal. And it's not that Meltdown I'm not really proud of it, but it was never a lifetime goal because it wasn't a route until I did it, right? So I always just see it as a different light, in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, and I know this is probably super taboo because you're not supposed to measure yourself off of others, but until Carlo did it, and then honestly, until more recently, until like it's had, Babsy, Jacopo, and Connor, I just never knew if it was that hard, you know? Like, yes, it was hard for me, but 5'9" Offwitz in the valley are really hard for me. So I didn't know how hard it was, like, on the actual scale of, you know, climbing. And so once other people started doing it and saying that it was like really hard, probably harder than I thought it was, then maybe it didn't hold more meaning, but maybe I just like look at myself in a little bit of a different light in that era, right? Like, especially because I just like cascaded down after that. Like sometimes I'm like, huh, maybe I was okay, you know? Maybe I was kind of good. Whereas like if it's just something that's never maybe repeated and you're like, I don't know, like it was hard for me, but I still have never done Ahab and Royal Robbins free sold that in the 1960s. So like, I don't know how hard it is, you know? So once these people that are like clearly really good at rock climbing said it was pretty hard, I was like, oh, maybe it is kind of hard.
I mean, well, one of the things to point out, you know, back to this idea of downplaying things is, I mean, you talk about in the book about just the sort of trepidation you had about rating it, what you did, and you kind of were talked into it in a lot of ways. But, you know, you're still a Valley person. Why did it take so long to get repeated other than, were people actually trying it, or did it just languish there? In some ways, the way the nose did too. I mean, it took forever for anyone to even free climb anything else on El Cap, actually. There's kind of like Lynn just opened the door and closed the door because people just walked away for another, you know, 5-6 years really before they were even frequently up there trying to free climb. So what do you think? I mean, what was about Meltdown that, is it just hidden? Is it wet all the time? Like, or were people trying it that you know of?
Yeah, no. And to the point of Lynn, like, people were trying the nose, just nobody could do it, right? Yeah. I mean, like, do you guys remember that Francois and Yuji trip? You know, they were going to come to America and do like all the hardest things. Mm-hmm. I mean, those guys were like the best of the best, and like, they couldn't do it. Like, the Hubers couldn't do it. Like, literally no one could do the nose because Lynn was just amazing, right? She just so far ahead of her time. And then they all had excuses. It was like, oh, because of her small fingers and stuff. And it's just like, well, they just needed something to pad their ego because, I mean, have you seen Tommy's fingers? They're like fatter than sausages, you know? So it wasn't that. It was just Lynn was so far ahead of her time. As far as Meltdown, yeah, people tried it. Like, I went up and I watched Enzo Odo on it. You know, like, Nico tried it, Sonny tried it, Tommy tried it when I was trying it. And then afterwards, like, people were trying it, you know, Mason, all the usual suspects. It's like 200 feet from the road. It's like tilted slightly, so you actually can't see it from the road, but it's not that far. But yeah, you can't climb it in the spring, but you also can't climb a lot of things in the spring. So I'm sure I could come up with excuses for people. Like, it's the only thing up there. So maybe if you don't have another partner that wants to shove their fingers in small granite crevices, nobody wants to try it. But yeah, I don't know. Trust me, I've questioned this a lot.
I know.
These were all people that I thought were way better rock climbers than myself. Right.
That's what I mean. It's like, I know the answer. It's because it was too hard for them. That's what the answer, it's a simple answer, Beth, but it's funny that you like kind of wouldn't, it took you that long to sort of accept that it's like, it was a really, really hard rock climb that the best rock climbers in the world couldn't do. And that's the answer to why it didn't get done. You know, it's awesome.
It took
getting done for you to be like, okay, I guess it's that hard. It's like ironic in a way.
It's also really cool to hear you say that it's the meaning of that route has changed for you, because the route's name kind of alludes to, you know, the meltdown of your marriage and maybe some of your health issues with your body, you know, breaking down and kind of everything falling apart in your life at that time, right? When you were climbing as hard as you've ever climbed. And so I think it had this negative connotation, but it's interesting to hear, like, 10 years on, you know, the response from other people who've added their, put in the blood and tears and sweat and, you know, whippers to do the route themselves have, maybe changed the meaning for you, or at least improved the way that you think of it.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I feel like I went up, and watched Connor try it this year. Yeah, I guess he did it this year, right? Or not, I guess this fall. And Babsy was there and stuff. And I hadn't gone down to the route since I did the filming segment for Josh, you know, February of 2008. So what is that, 15 years later or something like that? And it was cool. I thought it was going to be like a total mind trip, and it kind of was, but it was also kind of like, oh yeah, we're here at this rock climb and go Connor go, you know, and to hang out there with Babsy and stuff too. So it's cool. It's like, yeah, it's a, I don't know. I mean, I think things change their meaning in your life a lot, and it's held this place, and it's cool to go back and revisit it and also hear about everybody else's experience on it. So yeah, who knew? Just a piece of granite.
Well, you know, it's the, you talked about how important Lynn Hill's, you know, first descent was, and that was a meaningful route to you because it had been established, and this experience of making your own first descent was just kind of this nebulous thing that didn't actually mean anything until someone else repeated it on some level, because there was no, you didn't know how hard it was. It was just like this project that you had, and then it was done and out of your life. But you see the ripple effects of what a first ascent means, you know, so you got that experience that Lynn has of being able to, you know, establish something that no one else had done at the time, and then see the climbing community rise to those efforts to repeat it and have their own experiences, yeah. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's one of the coolest things about climbing, right? Is it's the same medium, but it's a totally different experience for everybody, because, you know, we're all different people, humans, and that's pretty cool that we all try the same thing, but we have our own stories with it.
So the Lynn Hill comparisons, you know, or non-comparisons as they were, I find it, I have a question like about sort of the grace or lack of, I mean, that's kind of the question of you, you know, we're talking about like meltdown. This was you were climbing better than you ever have. And, you know, implicit in that, maybe you ever will, you know, like, you know, it's like you're part of your media now is you're a mom, and that's your dedication, and climbing has to take this back seat to that. Or we introduce it into our family in a way that's healthy, I think, is a lot of like your messages. But, you know, what kind of grace do you have? You walk up to the climb to watch, you know, to be there with Connor. That puts you as this icon in a way of a role model of on the other side of that person who's, you know, gifted this climb to the community. Like, how is that with you? How has like your relationship with climbing and that moving into that kind of role as one of the greats, you know, but past your prime, or you know, however you want to look at it. Like put that all into perspective.
I don't know. I don't know if I can ever get enough therapy to consider myself one of the greats. So I'm just a human bumbling through life. Yeah, I mean, I went out there with Connor and I was like psyched that Connor and his friend Max taught Theo how to skip rocks. Like that was the coolest part of the day, you know, for me. And I think my evolution in climbing has tried to just have a healthier relationship with it, you know? Like in my peak, it was all just about one thing, about sending, you know, and which is, I get it, right? I think we all have had that hunger. We still probably all have that hunger. And now I just like, I really, some of my favorite days are just going out and climbing with my friends and laughing. Like, isn't that what it's about, you know? And so I just feel like I don't really see myself differently than the person next to me at the crag, you know. I used to, and not in that I'm a great, in the way of, oh shit, I hope they don't watch me and I hope I don't fall, because then they're gonna say something to somebody and they're gonna realize I'm a fraud. But now I go out and I'm just somebody trying to enjoy rock climbing, you know, out there with my friends and family and do that. So like that day with Connor was cool. I definitely didn't see myself as his elder other than just being older than him. You know, I was just appreciative that he was there and having a good time. And yeah, that's it. I don't think I see myself as in a different role or with a title or anything. I'm just Beth.
On the latest bonus episode for Rope Guns Only, we talked to one of the best pure rock climbers on the planet, Ethan Pringle. Ethan has been a professional for over 20 years and put up boulders, sport climbs, and trad routes all at the top of their respective scales. Both Andrew and I have been astonished in person by Ethan's ability to move on rock with uncanny power and precision. On this bonus episode for Rope Guns Only, we reflect with Ethan on 20 years in the biz and at the top of the game. Available with all our bonus material at patreon.com/runoutpodcast, where, for $5.14 a month, you can support the show and feel the love. That's patreon.com/runoutpodcast, where you can send $5.14 every month for the rest of your life. On today's final bit, we feature the second appearance of multi-instrumentalist Mason Earle. You may recall some Bach plucked on the lute way back on episode 54. Now, Mason returns under the nom de plume Beezer, turning his considerable musical talents to digital audio with the song Logger Sports, also available on Mason's YouTube channel. And personally, I'd recommend a nice set of headphones for this one.
You've just listened to another episode of the Run Out Podcast. If you like our show, the best way to support us is by giving us money. We don't care about iTunes ratings. You can share it with your friends or don't, whatever. But we are 100% listener supported because we believe this is the best way to stay independent, say what we think, and be accountable to the most important people in our lives, which is you, our listeners. To support our show, check us out on Patreon. It's patreon.com/runoutpodcast. For as little as $5.14 a month, you can become part of the Runout Nation and get bonus episodes that will titillate your ear holes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.